I, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, dedicate this day of Sunday to America, armed and free.
If you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I am a minute man. I am the guardian of America, armed and free. For we knew it will always be the citizen who is the guardian of America, armed and free.
Welcome to America Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
Yes, indeed we are, and we have another one of those uniformed guardians on with us. Admiral Edmund P. Giambastiani Jr. is an admiral, United States Navy, retired. He is currently chairman of the board of directors, Alenia North America, and previous to that, he retired from active duty on October 1st, 2007. He most recently served as the nation's seventh vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was at the time the second highest ranking military officer in the United States. It is a joy, a pleasure, and an honor to welcome to the deck of America Armed and Free, Admiral Giambastiani. Sir, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much, Charles. It's nice to be with you here today, and it's also nice to hear that Tony Tate has spent the last hour with you.
Yep, and he's online with you right now.
Hey, sir, Tony Tate here. Congratulations on all your success, and very proud of you.
Well, thank you, Tony. We're proud of you, too. I appreciate very much all the work you've done for the 10th Mountain Division, for the Joint Improvised Explosive Device Defeat Organization. That's a mouthful, but it's a very important operation. And thanks for what you've been doing over the years. Tony and I worked together back in 2003 when I was at the commander of United States Joint Forces Command. We worked in what was called our Joint Experimentation Division.
You know, that's awesome, sir. No wonder you made 4-star. You master the details of things, and I didn't even get to that in an in-depth 1-hour interview, and you go right to it. That's awesome. Could you explain, if you would, as long as you brought it up, Admiral Giambastiani, why that is such a vital function for the Army to do?
Well, for the Joint Improvised Explosive Device Defeat Organization, I'll just call it JIDO from now on, if that's okay.
It works for me.
Okay, great. Look, this is an organization, and Tony lives and breathes this every day, but as vice chairman, and frankly in my role before that as a commander of United States Joint Forces Command, I and we spent a huge amount of time breaking down barriers to allow this organization to conduct research and development, test products, systems, processes, and if you will, tactics, the rest of it, to come up with solutions to defeat improvised explosive devices to protect our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in combat, specifically and most notably in Iraq and Afghanistan. But what I mean by breaking down the barriers, Congress correctly appropriated money, large amounts in the billions, and Tony can tell you what the current budget is, and it's given latitude that almost no other organization is given. For example, the head of the Improvised Explosive Defeat Organization works directly, actually, for the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And when I was the vice chairman, the deputy and I spent a huge amount of time with retired General Montgomery Meigs. Now it's active duty Lieutenant General Metz, who's the head. And these gentlemen and their staff figured out how to spend money to buy devices, to buy technology to help defeat these, to find the bomb makers, to defeat, if you will, the chain of events that leads up to a detonation, and also to help in the technology to protect our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. And I can't think of anything more important than that.
Wow. General Tata, how does that come to, at the business end, you know, Admiral Giambastiani is dealing with the planning end of it. At the business end of it, what does that look like? How are you?
I'm not sure that I can improve on Admiral G's description, but I'll try to elaborate. We operate from a train the force, attack the network, and defeat the device framework. And so there's a lot of training that has to go on because you don't want, as Admiral G articulated, you don't want people getting over there not knowing what they're using. And so there's all this new equipment that we're buying, and they need to know how to use it. So there's a huge training piece, and our budget's $4.5 billion. That's what it's being. And so about half of that goes toward buying technology, as Admiral G said, that helps us better detect and mitigate against a blast. Obviously, we want to detect it. We want to find those networks. We want to detect the bombs, and we want to mitigate if we don't detect and defuse ahead of time. And then, so that's about half of that $4.5 billion. And then about a third, about 40% goes toward attacking the network, and that's fusion of intelligence and operations in both countries. And there's a chain of events, as Admiral G described, that there's financiers, there's bomb makers, there's transporters, there's emplacers, there's scouts, there's detonators, and all of that has certain signatures. And so we've spent a lot of time and effort trying to sort of paint the network. We look at it as the invisible man, and we're trying to throw dust on it to see where it is and find it. And then the last piece is training the force, you know, training these troops to get into an offensive mindset to attack that network, because if you're just playing defense on this thing, it's already in the ground, and you've already really kind of lost that.
You're way behind the OODA loop in that case. Stand by for just a moment. Admiral Giambastiani, what were you able to do from a perspective of Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs to knock down any inter-service rivalries there might have been that might have stood in the way of training various cooperative branches of the military?
It's a good question, Charles, and let me make two points to talk about this. When I said break down the barriers, we also meant the service barriers.
Right.
It's right to the question you're asking.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing to remember, though, is we said we want to reduce the amount of time to get solutions out there if they're tactics, training solutions, equipment, whatever, as Tony elaborated. But when you do that, on occasion, you're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes and buy a piece of equipment that's not particularly effective. Fortunately, most of Congress understands that. This is one of those few times where, because we're trying to get stuff out into the field as quickly as possible, on occasion, you make a mistake. The other piece is we tried to reduce the amount of mother may-eyes, if you will, the amount of people that the head of JIDO would have to ask permission for in order to approve and spend money. So, for example, under his signature at the time, he could spend up to $25 million. And finally, and he didn't have to ask anybody else for that expenditure authority.
My wife would love a credit card like that.
Exactly. And then, but, you know, this, again, is directly to save lives, and that's why it's so important. So these are the kind of barriers we broke down. Now, in all fairness, the Army, because they have the largest group of forces on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, wanted to control the JIDO organization completely. Now, you'll notice we have many Army officers, but the problem is we have large numbers of Marines. We have large numbers of sailors over there. A lot of people don't realize that in Iraq and Afghanistan, here I am an ex-Navy officer, retired, but we've got 14,000 sailors out there in addition to all of those significant numbers of soldiers and Marines, but a tremendous number of Air Force personnel out there. So the bottom line is that each of these services bring unique skills and unique organizations. I was asked back in 2004 to do a review of JIDO when I worked down at U.S. Joint Forces Command, the forerunner to JIDO. We were looking at all of the organizations that were out there that we're working on trying to defeat explosive these explosive events. And as it turns out, there were 154 separate organizations working on this, and none of them were coordinating and working together. To the best of my knowledge, we took my lessons learned team and reviewed this for a period of 3 months and came back and reported that we needed to have a Manhattan Project-like level of effort to take care of it. And that's how the JIDA organization actually came about and how we got to this. And we actually made it a joint organization as opposed to one led by any service.
And how is that working out in the field? General Tata, if I may?
Yeah, it's, Admiral G is characteristically modest. Without his leadership, I don't know that we would be where we are today. And what he helped create with the DepSecDef's leadership is a very streamlined organization that is unimpeded by the bureaucracy. And so we have very quick turnaround time. We have rapid acquisition authority, and we are turning out equipment in months that is actually, saving soldiers' lives, because this threat is morphing all over the place. And we go high tech, he goes low tech. We go back to low tech, he goes high tech. And so we are actually trying to get ahead of him and be there before he gets there. And we could not do that if we were had all of the Mother May eyes, as Admiral G said. We could not do that if we did not have this sort of pristine, unencumbered organization. It's lean, and it is absolutely focused on the downrange piece, and we have teams downrange. There's a field team in Afghanistan and a field team in Iraq that's part of our organization, and they are advising commanders, and they are the portal all the way back to Northern Virginia here with all of our other operations. So that $4.5 billion gets spent very, very well, and we have review boards that are very quick. We do them weekly, and we are absolutely taking all comers from academia, from industry. Any good idea out there, we listen to, and we make a very quick decision on it. And we have the room to fail, because not everything's going to work. And so Admiral G and the DepSecDef underwrote that and said, we understand that not everything's going to be perfect, and some of this money will go toward things that fail.
It reminds me of, in large part, of what went on with the Skunk Works at Lockheed and Kelly Johnson's work that developed all those great airplanes. You know, great minds coming together to do things without being impeded in their ability to do it. Gentlemen, we're up on our first break. General Tata, I appreciate your participation, and we're going to continue on with Admiral Giambastiani. You know how hard that is to remember which one's the admiral and which one's the general? Stand by for just a little bit.
You're listening to America Armed and Free.
Welcome back to this portion of America Armed and Free with Admiral Edmund Giambastiani. He's the retired Deputy Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I wanted to say, I didn't have a chance to at the top of the hour, thank you for your service to the country in 37 years in the United States military, Admiral.
Thank you, Charles. Very much appreciate it. And I was very proud to serve, actually, and spent 4 years at the Naval Academy. Mm-hmm. And so 41 years in uniform. Very proud of that service, and lots of folks in my family and in my wife's family served also, but thank you.
You know, you stayed in the Navy, and indeed you ascended to the very top ranks over, as you point out, a 41-year career. What attracted you to naval service, and what kept you there for such a phenomenal length of time?
Books, number one. When I was a young man, I had a dentist in my hometown of Canastota, New York, a little town of 4,000, a farming village. in upstate New York near Syracuse, and I had a dentist who had served as an Air Force dentist at the Air Force Academy when it was stood up. And he loved reading books about World War II, and he gave me 50 books to read that are all classics. Bob, Black Sheep, I still have them all.
Right, by the commander of the, Pappy Boynton.
Pappy Boynton, exactly.
Right, yeah.
And books like that, Stuka Pilot,
Zero
Pilot, there were all kinds of these things, and I just read them, and I loved them. I think I was about 12 years old, and I decided I wanted to go in the service.
Mm. Have you read Admiral Ellsberg's On the Bottom?
I sure have.
Oh, that was the first book my father ever read to me, and he wonders why I became a wreck diver.
Well, you have to remember, obviously, we don't want to have submarines on the bottom, and it's
no.
A wonderful description of the Squalus.
Yes.
And I'm sure you remember it only too well, but
yep.
I have a copy of it. It's the cover's damaged, but it's a great book. Haven't read it in many years, though.
I read it. It was the first book my dad read to me when I was a child, and the last week of his life, I read it back to him, the exact same book. And it's funny, the cover on mine is damaged, too. It's his old book. I think, though, that it was the S-51 they were raising.
You're right. Yeah, I think you're correct.
The Squalus, I think, was Swede Momsen's rescue.
That was Swede Momsen's recovery.
Yeah, in 1937.
A very famous recovery. You're exactly right. You can see how many years it's been since I read it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that I name all my devices, and my Palm Pilot is called the Squalefish. Because, you know, the combined name of Sailfish, they renamed, let's not get off on it. We'll go on a complete tangent. We got callers, too, and I want to be respectful of their time. Wayne,
sure.
Quick question for Admiral Giambastiani, retired deputy chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Quick comment or question, Wayne.
Yes, sir. We know that many components from Iran have been found in high penetration type IEDs. I know that some Iranian agents have been caught, and I was wondering, was there ever a combination where they caught them shooting them off, and how bad is that situation in today?
Please take your answer on the air. And Admiral Giambastiani?
First of all, thanks for your question. Now, I'm a bit dated, and so my latest information on improvised explosive devices dates back to before October of 2007, and at that time we had made a number of public announcements, public affairs press releases out of Iraq in Baghdad to show what types of components, specifically the explosively formed projectiles, that were coming there. But to the best of my knowledge, we can confirm nothing that I know of that would answer your question. However, again, I'm not fully up to date on the latest and the greatest, if you will.
All right. And Tom, you're live on America Armed and Free with Admiral Giambastiani. A quick question, if you would.
Yeah. My question is that it's always puzzled me why those dumps were not immediately secured. And I say this in view of... I know some World War II veterans, and you know, it was just a matter of course. I mean, virtually every town in Germany, even years after the war, all the arms were collected and secured, you know. Why this wasn't done in Baghdad, you know.
Okay, good question. Admiral Giambastiani?
Again, another great question. Let me give you a quick thought. I don't recall exactly the total amount of unexpended ordnance, and that's what this is called, that existed in Iraq at the time. But I know when we were tracking this on a month-to-month basis, when I retired, I think we had destroyed something like 400,000 tons of this stuff. Now, think about the magnitude of that. That's a hell of a lot of ordnance. And there was still quite a bit out there. It was, you remember that Iraq was probably one of the largest arms purchasers in the 1980s under Saddam Hussein.
It said he never saw a weapon system he didn't buy.
Exactly. And in fact, on a number of occasions, other than you know, large countries like the Soviet Union in the 80s or the United States, they were buying more conventional ammunition than anyone in the world. So they had these tremendous stockpiles. So think about the scope and the scale and the magnitude. On a number of these places, they would be buried and locked so that they could come back and revisit them to destroy them. It was the scale of the amount of ammunition in Iraq is beyond just about anybody's ability to imagine it.
It's a shame Saddam wasn't Jewish. He could have made a profit on all that stuff selling it to the Israelis. Larry, you're live on America Armed and Free with Admiral Giambastiani.
Hi, thank you. I don't know, I've been listening since the Admiral came online, and this question may not follow where you're trying to go with the show, so if not, just tell me so, and that's fine. It's a, my question, however, is about military service and the commissioning oath and dissent when we feel that the country is going the wrong direction.
That's completely appropriate. Please proceed.
Okay, you're okay with that?
I'm fine with it.
All right, I'm a commissioned officer in one of the services, as is the Admiral, as was the General before him. And my sense since I took the commissioning oath beaucoup years ago was that if the day ever came when I thought that the president, whom I had sworn to support, was going in the wrong direction, I needed to resign my commission and protest from the outside. But I hear many, many officers, and this is not directed at the Admiral specifically or anybody, but I hear many, many senior officers, mostly retired, on the air expressing opinions, and some of them agree with what the president is doing and some don't. I'm troubled about my commissioning oath and my obligation versus my discomfort with where the country's going. Does the Admiral have
explain
trouble
before you answer, before you ask it, before he answers, please explain troubled very briefly.
Well, as I say, I'm retired now. I've been happily collecting a retirement check from the government for many years, and I am so troubled by the direction the country is taking.
Please explain
right now.
Please explain what you mean
by
troubled.
I mean that I think that we are surrendering our country's specialness. You know, there's been a lot of coverage in the news the last couple of days. We're surrendering our specialness to other countries that couldn't begin to compete with us in a fair contest.
American exceptionalism is what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, stand by. Let's have Admiral Giambastiani's response.
Let me, I think it's a very good question, Larry, and here's the way I would answer you. We train our military folks. I spent a lot of time over my career talking to young officers about the fact that you can disagree with an order, but my example to most people was, if it isn't over what I would consider to be a matter of principle, and of course, matter of principle to some would be open to question, let me give you a very clear example, and that would be to kill unarmed hostages. Or you've been given an order to do something that you know is fundamentally wrong, and it is a matter of principle. You have a choice to disobey that order, and if necessary, you resign your commission in the case of an officer. This has happened on occasion, and my view on this is that a lot of civilians and even some junior military officers don't recognize the difference between a military officer doing this and, for example, a civilian in a position in the government. Both are doing it probably out of a matter of principle. The difference is the military officer doesn't get a chance to come back. You get one shot at doing this, but that's appropriate, and you just have to understand that when it comes to that point, you're ready to resign your commission. Whereas a civilian certainly can come back in another role and in another administration and another political position at some point later on. But it's over a matter of principle is probably the easiest way I can describe it for you. Now, if you have a problem because you don't like the amount of taxation that's going on and the rest of those things, certainly you can resign and write a letter and describe the reasons why you want to retire or resign. The government will probably accept that at some point, but the point is that you don't like the direction. But, I mean, you have that opportunity.
All right, Larry, I'm going to allow you a quick follow-up because it was such a good question.
Well, my quick follow-up is, thank you, sir. I appreciate your input on that. It, as I say, it is a question of, am I troubled enough by what's going on to resign my commission? It probably wouldn't make a great deal of difference in my life circumstances. It would be nothing more than a statement.
It would if the entire Joint Chiefs did it, but I don't think that's ever going to happen, and maybe I can ask Admiral Giambastiani, or maybe that's not appropriate, and we'll go on to the next thing. Stand by for just a little bit.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
We go to sea on diesel boats, they call us Bubblehead. Our blood is laced with diesel smoke, we're sailors to the end. Our diesels whine through the salty brine until we take her deep. Then we turn her loose on battery juice, then we all go to sleep. Diesel boats forever, hear the diving klaxon sound. Diesel boats forever, take her deep, take her down.
And welcome back to this segment of America Armed and Free, where we have the joy, the pleasure, and the special honor of having with us the fairly recently retired Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Ed Giambastiani. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Charles. I'm pleased to be here today again, and looking forward to additional questions.
You know, I don't know if you know the fellow who did that music. It's Tommy Cox, who was retired as an E-9. He was a commo tech on Lapon and several other boats. And he's got a couple albums of submarine music, but he talks about diesel boats forever. And the United States does not do diesel boats anymore. We've gone all over to nuclear. You've been a skipper of a fast attack boat. In fact, if I remember right, the boat you were skipper of was the last Sturgeon-class attack boat that we had, right?
Very good, Charles. The SSN 687, the USS Richard B. Russell. In fact, our motto was, we save the best till last.
Yeah, that's great. And does it feel, I don't know, does it feel strange to be in a class of boats that is the last one of its breed and that there's something new coming on, or is it exciting to spawn something new?
Well, I think it's exciting to create new submarines and ships and create new things. I hate to say this, but how you and I came together through Joel Greenberg, a Navy Reserve commander, is the fact that I commanded also the world's smallest nuclear-powered, deep-diving, ocean engineering submersible, submarine NR-1.
NR-1, and that's what and NR-1 is what I wanted to get to next. But what I want to really know, though, Admiral Giambastiani, is what was it that Commander Greenberg taught you that made you so successful in your career?
Well, look, I've got so many mentors that have caused me to be successful. I spend an awful lot of time talking to young people. In fact, I was just at the Naval Academy last night with my wife at a submarine birthday ball with 230 other folks, 120 new midshipmen who are going into submarines from the Naval Academy. And the whole purpose of this is to mentor these young people and to help give them the foundation, the kind of foundation that guys like Joel Greenberg and others do to people all the time. In other words, to give back and train and provide them with a basis and a foundation where they can make good, sound decisions and be good, solid leaders.
And he does that. He works on scholarships for people in ROTC. It's a commendable effort. The NR-1 was in the Naval Service for 40 years before it was decommissioned. What are some of the missions you did as the skipper of the NR-1 that you might actually be able to talk about?
Sure. In fact, it's a great question for the NR-1 because that submarine did missions that were from totally unclassified to top secret. And I did all kinds of those missions in the over 3 years I was on the submarine, almost 3.5 years from 1982, January of 82, to May of 1985. And as a matter of fact, we brought the submarine NR-1 in a March 1985 edition of National Geographic magazine, for those that have got DVDs and can pull them up, there is a great article about submarine NR1 when I was in command with Dr. Bob Ballard, the mm-hmm. discoverer of the Titanic,
yep.
the Bismarck, and Roman Rex, galleons, mm-hmm. and many other things throughout his life. He's a PhD. He's an expert in plate tectonics. And Bob and I have been friends for about 25 years. And as it turns out, NR1 was used in many of these missions. But let me give you a couple examples. One time I was driving on the bottom in about 800 feet of water on our rolling wheels. We had two big truck tires filled with alcohol. We'd lower the landing gear, sit on a flat bottom, and drive along. And I had scientists on board, and we were studying tilefish. A lot of people don't know that it's the second most caught commercial fish on the East Coast, which is pretty remarkable. But we were studying tilefish populations. Now, we had a couple of scientists from Lamont Doherty Geologic Observatory at Columbia University. I've also took Bob Ballard up into the Reykjanes Ridge, which is the mid-Atlantic ridge that comes down from Iceland, but it goes completely around the world.
Is that where the plates meet?
And it's exactly. That's oh. exactly where the plates meet.
Oh.
And in fact, Bob Ballard was the one who discovered the underwater hot water vents off the Galapagos Island on the other side of the world. And we were looking for potential hot water vents in submarine NR1, 150 miles south of Iceland on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And that's another one. And that's the article that's featured in National Geographic. Those are two very classics. Other things, we'd go out and recover things. We'd go out and look for Roman wrecks or shipwrecks. There are just a lot of stuff that we did.
What would be the tie-in of Roman wrecks to the military, or is it strictly, or because NR1 was an unarmed vessel, and because it was mostly for research, where's the nexus between looking at historical wrecks and doing things for science? Where's the line between them, or is there one?
Well, because NR1 was an unusual ship, and you correctly pointed out it was unarmed. In fact, the only weapon we had on board, if you want to call it that, was a line throwing gun, and the reason for the ship was for research and development, and one of the large funders of the ship through the Navy was the Navy's Office of Naval Research. And many applications for missions would come in from a number of different places. Now, why would you go out and, for example, all of the equipment that Bob Ballard, most of the equipment that Bob Ballard used to find the Titanic was actually tested on submarine NR1. When I was the officer in charge.
Hmm.
And the reason why we would use NR1 for this is to test out new cameras, new search equipment, new sonar equipment, and absolutely the best way to give something a real test is to go out and look for something that hasn't been found.
You need a target for the mission.
You got it. And that's exactly why we would do a lot of these missions.
It turns out, it's recently come out that the Titanic mission was kind of a cover for going after pictures of USS Scorpion, and most of those pictures are still not public information. It's kind of interesting. Are you with me?
I lost you for just a second.
I said,
I'm sorry, Charles.
It's
you were just saying that it was a cover for the and I missed that part.
The Scorpion. The Titanic mission turns out recently to have been a cover. We find out recently to have been a cover for going after trying to discover what actually happened to Scorpion, you know, the details of what may have happened to Scorpion. It's kind of interesting.
It's amazing what happens in life, isn't it?
Yeah, and I notice you're not going there, so we won't. And Joel, you're live on America Armed and Free with Admiral Jim Bastiani. Your comment or question?
Yeah, as long as you guys want to use my name in vain over the air, I'd figure I would call in. And first of all, Ed, thanks for being on Charles's show. It's great to have what you're talking about heard here out in the middle of the desert in cowboy country. And secondly, it's an honor and a privilege to call you Admiral G in front of everybody.
Yeah, back when you guys were both lieutenant commanders together, right?
Commanders, yep.
Yep.
Joel, thank you so much for all you've done over the years and what you continue to do to help out. I think I'm an honorary member of the Naval Reserve Community letter from Arizona and a number of other things.
Yes, our military, Charles, I put the Admiral on distribution for our monthly newsletter.
There you go, military officers.
Our local military officers group. Mm-hmm. Which Charles is a good supporter of, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask both of you a question, if you'll bear with us for just a little bit. And first I'm going to ask Admiral Giambastiani and then Joel. Admiral Giambastiani, what is it we can do to make sure that our military, what is it we as civilians, members of this audience, can do to make sure that our military has the support it needs from the civilian side in order to maintain what it needs to do for the country?
Frankly, being active with your members of Congress is incredibly important. They respond to query, pressure, to letters, calls. They respond, and they must respond, because obviously they've been elected by you. It's important, frankly, to ask the hard questions, show up at town hall meetings, and in fact, engage with them in a way that makes them answer these tough questions, the kind that they should be asking, so that they will fund the programs that properly protect our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and provide that insurance policy that the U.S. military provides for our country and our life.
Joel, brief answer. We're up on the break. We're only about 10 seconds out.
Holy Charles, you know I can never be brief. I would agree with the Admiral. Also, in politics, there's a term retail politics, which means boots on the ground and talking to the individual voters. And that really is what I do, and what's really important is to talk with individuals. And you've seen me do this. Find out who they are, have they served, if they haven't, what they know about it, and show them that and get talk with school kids and be on the radio with you to for the people, who the general public, to understand what it is that we do and how good it is that we do it, and the sacrifices that have been made.
Yeah, Joel, you work so hard at it, I would think sometimes you were enlisted.
Yeah, I had a few months of that, too.
I'm just giving you a hard time, Joel. All right, we're up on that next break.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Die, die. Take her deep. Take her down where no other human being can be found. Below the surface where it's dark and green, down to the sea in a big black submarine.
Welcome back to America Armed and Free, where we have the joy, the pleasure, and the honor of this last segment with Admiral Edmund Giambastiani. He's the retired Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at many, many, many phenomenally successful and responsible positions through the Navy that I don't have time to go through, but among them, he was a submarine commander. You also commanded for the Pentagon the submarine force of the United States, did you not?
Yes, I did.
So many, many positions. How is the support for the military? We were talking a little bit about that, but some of the things we can do as an audience, as civilians, to support the role of the military in the United States. How does the support today compare to what you experienced, say, in the Vietnam era?
Well, let me give it to you this way, because it's a great question, Charles. I went to the Naval Academy between 66 and 70, and I graduated in June of 70. I can remember only too well that when I went home on leave, my parents and everybody would want you to wear your uniform, and we didn't, because we just didn't want to be demonstrated against and the rest of it. It's not that we weren't proud of it, but we were also trying to relax and have some time off. And in Washington, when I went to at the Navy Recruiting Command at the beginning of the all-volunteer force, in 1975, we wore our uniforms in Washington, D.C. as military officers only one day a week. The other four, we wore suits. And the reason is we didn't want to, quote, show that military presence in the Washington. And this, of course, was at the end of the Vietnam War and throughout this entire time. Today, life couldn't be more different. And I talk about incidents like this and that experience that I had to talk about great support that the military gets today across America. Just watching soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines fly through air terminals, for example, and how they are greeted and how they are taken care of on airlines back, and the average citizen just thanking people for their service, it really is quite remarkable the difference today compared to back during Vietnam.
You know, yesterday, to camp onto that, yesterday I went down to Tombstone to go to a gun show, and on the way back I stopped at a Kentucky Fried Chicken, and a fella next to me had a Marine Corps hat on, and I looked at him and said, thank you for your service, and he says, you're welcome. I said, where did you serve? He says, well, I went to boot camp on December 9th, 1941, and they sent me to Tarawa and to, I think he said Okinawa. And he was in the second wave at Tarawa. And,
wow.
And I just, you know, and I just stood there with my mouth open. The guy was 83. I would have pegged him for 71. And it just, you know, and I just couldn't be grateful enough for his service. There's still those guys out there.
There's a lot of them out there, and they're wonderful people.
Yeah. Did anything surprise you upon being, when you got to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and you became the vice chairman, did anything about your service on the Joint Chiefs surprise you, or was it something that you didn't expect?
I hadn't thought about it in quite that way, but the answer is I don't think anything surprised me. It was just 7x24 by 365. It was a very busy 2 years as vice chairman. I loved it, but it was incredibly active, and I can't say as though anything really surprised me, except for maybe one thing that I recall. I believe it was July 4th, 2006, when North Korea launched about 7 missiles in one day.
Hmm.
And you can go back and look at the news reports and the rest of it, but the fact that they launched so many missiles and to see what they're doing today, trying to demonstrate and use these demonstrations of their prowess and the rest of it, it gives you a bit of pause, and it doesn't make any difference which administration is doing it.
Kind of makes you wish that we had that airborne green laser in the 747 operational already, doesn't it?
Hopefully it's still working.
Oh, it is? It is operational? Or you can't say?
No, what I would tell you is that, again, I'm going to give you up through October of 2007. We're working very hard to keep the that one aircraft funded and continue doing testing. And at that time, although the progress was slow, it was moving along, and we'll see how successful it is.
Now, moving on, you are the chairman of the board of a substantial company, Alenia or Alenia, you say?
Alenia.
Alenia North America, which makes both military and civilian aircraft parts and in some sections, and I believe some whole aircraft as well. According to your website, Alenia Aeronautica has a substantial role in the production of the 787 airliner, which I believe is called the Dreamliner. They manufacture the central and the rear fuselage sections and the horizontal stabilizer. How does the ability to coordinate military programs and procurement transfer over to the civilian side in terms of making a company successful?
Yeah, what I quickly say is Alenia North America is the North American subsidiary of Alenia Aeronautica, which is actually an Italian aircraft company that's been in service for over 100 years. And Alenia North America produces a joint cargo aircraft called the C-27J that the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force is buying. It essentially looks like a twin-engine C-130.
Mm-hmm.
And Alenia Aeronautica produces the fuselages, components, and the rest, if you will, because Italy is buying a significant number of 787 Dreamliners. So as part of all of these negotiated arrangements around the world, Boeing actually procures components from different sections. And so we have, if you will, two separate and distinct entities taking care of the military side and also taking care of the civilian side.
Mm-hmm. If President Obama has his way, you may be making Chryslers pretty soon. One last call. Tom, you're live on America Armed and Free with Admiral Giambastiani. A quick comment or question. Down, we're under the last 4 minutes.
Yes, a privilege to speak with you, Admiral. Admiral, could you please comment, if you haven't, I'm sorry, Charles, about the new Chinese standoff missile with a 1,000-mile range and up to a Mach 10 speed that's definitely going to take out our carriers if we ever put them in that part of the world under hostile conditions?
Great. Take your answer on the air, Admiral Giambastiani.
Okay. Well, just very quickly, again, I haven't looked at the intel on this in a year and a half, but what I would tell you is that these are very capable, long-range, and as you said, very high-speed missiles. And defense in depth, if you will, to protect aircraft carriers is incredibly important in your ability to operate in a contested area if necessary, recognizing we're not in hostilities with the Chinese. But from a prudence standpoint, military forces clearly need to build capabilities, weapons, and defensive systems, and also offensive systems to be able to neutralize these. And I think that the U.S. Navy is working very hard, but these are very lethal, very, very capable missiles. Your question about it is important.
I think the rail gun will have something to do with defending against that if they can only find a guidance package, because we've already demonstrated our ability to hit a bullet with a bullet in terms of strategic defense. But if we can ramp it up to the rail gun and we can figure out a way to aim the rail gun at an incoming missile, I think we might have a technology at work. Then again, I haven't looked at the ins and outs of it, and I don't have a security clearance. What did you make of the song?
Well, one other piece, Charles, if I could, for a rail gun is you require a lot of electrical power.
Definitely.
One of the reasons why you want to, if you move to something like a rail gun technology, is you need electric propulsion systems to generate a lot of electrical power.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's true. Now, the other thing, what did you make of the Song class, the Chinese submarine that popped up some 600 yards away from one of our aircraft carriers in 2006?
Part of it is that today we're probably not quite as good at anti-submarine warfare as we were during the Cold War. We spent a huge amount of time worrying about Soviet submarines, tracking them, looking at them, watching them all the time, and the rest of it. And it's very unusual for another submarine to show up. And what it does is, on occasion, you can have a submarine penetrate a screen or something else, and what you have to do is be ever vigilant and keep your systems and your watch standards and the rest focused on not letting that happen.
Yeah, we don't have Whitey Mac anymore to tail them for 47 days. Commander, Admiral Giambastiani, it has been a joy, a pleasure, and an honor to have you aboard the Liberty Watch, and I just can't thank you enough for your service to the country. The theme music is playing, so we will have to let you go, but it's been a pleasure having you aboard, sir.
Charles, my pleasure, and the best to your audience. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
God bless you. God bless America. I want to encourage each and every one of you to be vigorous, not violent, be vigilant, not vituperative. In Liberty, I'm Charles Heller.
With freedom's holy light.